The Sunstone Foundation presents Bumping, on reconciling contemporary views of knowledge and causation with the restored gospel, recorded live at the 1989 Sunstone Symposium, held August 23rd through 26th in Salt Lake City, Utah. We now take you to the University of Utah campus where the program is about to begin.
The paper will be presented by Thomas Rogers, who was educated at the University of Utah, Yale University, and received his doctorate from Georgetown University in 1968 in Russian language and literature. He has taught at Howard University, the University of Utah, and is presently a professor of Russian at Brigham Young University. He has published various articles on Russian literature and has been involved in playwriting, directing, and acting at BYU. He and his wife Miriam are the parents of 7 children and the grandparents of 6. At the conclusion of his paper, we will have a response from David Allred, who has a PhD in physics and chemistry from Princeton University and now teaches physics at BYU. He is married to Janice, and they are the parents of 8 children. It looks as if we probably will not have time for questions at the end of the presentation, but we'll see. We'll go to that point.
Who besides musicologists has ever heard of Holzbauer, Mohn, Wagenseil, Dittersdorf, or Süssmayr, all well-known and respected contemporaries of Mozart and Haydn? Salieri is more familiar, but mostly because of his role in Peter Schaeffer's play, then film, as foil for the far more gifted Wolfgang Amadeus. There was also Beethoven's illustrious counterpart, Hummel. Just what has made these second-raters so second-rate and consigned their music to eternal oblivion? My musician friends tell me it is because, craftsmen though each of them was, there is never any surprise in what they turned out. Their work is all too predictable, and so we are not interested. In his instructive essay, Aspects of the Novel, E.M. Forster employs an arresting term for what he maintains all successful literary characters do to us. They bump us. Like the tantalizing progress of theme and variation in great music, they too, to some degree, defy our expectations. Okay, if this could be higher, it would help. Okay, closer. Just better directed. Okay. Oh, we don't have a mic. Okay, I'll just keep it real loud. Like the tantalizing progress of theme and variation in great music, these writers, according to Forster, to some degree defy our expectations, and because we cannot entirely figure them out, both intrigue us and strike us as somehow all the more lifelike. Think in this regard of what it was like, the generally shocking and completely unexpected surprise that attended your personal discovery, whenever it was, regarding sexual reproduction and how you came to be physically. Or of what the artists, then physicians, must have thought and felt who first dissected corpses and systematically explored what lies beneath the skin in each of us. The present generation, it is commonly observed, no longer troubles itself to learn about, let alone much revere, its roots, to concern itself, that is, with history and tradition. But perhaps this is partly due to the way history is mostly put to us, as something already well established, clearly understood, and agreed upon by the experts, lacking much, if any, uncertainty, and leaving little in the past to be discovered. In a remarkable distinguished lecture delivered this past year at Oxford University, H.R. Trevor Roper argues otherwise. Citing an array of instances, Trevor Roper suggests that significant historical outcomes are contingent and highly precarious, that much as we know it could have as easily turned out otherwise. History, he insists, is full of surprises, and if we lose the capacity to be surprised by it, we have lost the sense of it. Moreover, results do not necessarily conform to intentions, he says. He indicates, for instance, how close Mithraism, or the worship of Hermes, rather than Christianity, came to supplanting the other pagan cults. Indeed, with but a few small alterations in the later course of events, or say in the relative charisma and sanity of particular potentates, how likely it is we would now all be Muslims, or because of a more prudent Napoleon, speakers of French, or thanks to a more humane and decent, if equally ambitious and designing Hitler, of German. Such speculation, in which the review of events is, quote, flexible, aware at every stage both of the alternatives and the limitations, end quote, makes history truly come alive. yet how few, even in the classroom, have ever allowed themselves to perceive it in such dynamically tenuous terms. In addressing Princeton's Institute for Advanced Study last November, the distinguished elder statesman George F. Kennan voiced similar reservations about the historian Arnold Toynbee's vast generalizations. Kennan speaks of the extreme variations in time and place from which such comparisons are drawn and speculates on, quote, Toynbee's failure to take full account of the element of the fortuitous, of pure chance in the unfolding of human affairs, and his consequent assumption that everything that happened in those affairs had to have a reason visible and intelligible to the human eye, end quote. The current cumulative scientific understanding generally concedes a similar uncertainty about what is really out there and how much we really know. With increasing rapidity, physical and biological models are revised and updated as further discrepancies and incongruities come to scientists' attention. This is nowhere better perceived than by contemporary philosophers who base their assertions about the limitations and fallibility of our perceptions on the very constraints on thought which language itself necessarily imposes. In his landmark essay, Structure, Sign, and Play in the Discourse of the Human Sciences, Derrida speaks of a series of substitutions of center for center and states that particularly in the wake of, quote, the Nietzschean critique of metaphysics, the Freudian critique of consciousness, and the Heideggerian destruction of the determination of being as presence, end quote, any center must henceforth be seen as a function rather than a locus, and in terms of a system of differences. Derrida traces this same process in the method of his ethnologist predecessor, Levi Strauss. Similarly, the contemporary American pragmatist Richard Rorty, whose children are Mormons, by the way. Yes. Cites Thomas Kuhn's influential hypothesis regarding the process of scientific discovery, the structure of scientific revolutions. And the Harvard biologist Stephen Jay Gould asserts that, quote, our empirical world is a temporary sequence of complex events so unrepeatable by the laws of probability and so irreversible by the principles of thermodynamics that everything interesting happens only once in its meaningful details, end quote. In a remarkably comprehensive treatise entitled The Noble Dream, The Objectivity Question and the American Historical Profession, Cambridge University, 1988, Peter Novick of the University of Chicago reviews for us how in essentially all contemporary disciplines, history, science, philosophy, literary criticism, anthropology, legal studies, and psychoanalysis, the center does not hold. The title, in fact, of Novick's illuminating final chapter, whose metaphor in turn clearly derives from Eliot's Four Quartets. As regards theology and scriptural exegesis, perhaps no one has more cautiously examined the essential foundations of Christianity than the Loyola University philosopher Thomas Sheehan. According to Sheehan, and quote, in the post-religious dispensation that Jesus inaugurated, faith, that is, living the present future, means maintaining the undecidability of what is human and what is divine, end of quote. We nevertheless already encounter this radically reconstituted view of Christianity in some of our most profound literature, beginning with Dante's unrivaled Commedia, whose daring conflations of the sacred and profane view hell as an inverse paradiso and heaven in terms of the ancient world's most concupiscent commentary, Ovid's Metamorphoses. In Dostoevsky, we encounter an array of similarly paradoxical notions, salvation through the suffering that arises out of victimization and outright transgression, holiness and divinity in such fallen creatures as Crime and Punishment's Sonia Marmeladova and the Idiot's Nastasya Philippovna, faith and salvation in the prospect of one who, on the verge of murdering his neighbor, first prays and asks for forgiveness, thus acknowledging both God and his own wrongdoing. In The Idiot. With the public confession of the weak-willed Nikita in the stage play The Power of Darkness, Tolstoy's horrific depiction of peasant depravity, there also occurs an equally sublime spiritual transcendence. Similarly, when in The Death of Ivan Ilyich, the tormented protagonist asks himself, why these sufferings? The answer which comes to him, for no reason, they are just so, recalls nothing so much as Jesus' reply to his disciples regarding the man born blind. Neither hath this man sinned nor his parents, but that the works of God should be made manifest in him. The answer, if answer whatsoever, is one of tantalizing mystery, whose acceptance requires truly unprecedented faith in the essential rightness of such undecidability, uncertainty, contingency, or whichever of several current buzzwords one chooses for such lack of cognitive certitude and closure. Echoing Christ's final words on the cross, the dying Ivani Leach's last verbal encounter involves another character's observation, "It is finished." And Ivan's own corresponding thought, so opposite our common apprehension of death's finality, "Death is finished." We might also note Simone Weil's profound meditations on the spiritual aspect of reverent submissiveness to, however violent, evil, and seemingly impersonal the forms it takes, pure necessity. A submissiveness which presupposes and further acknowledges one's inevitable place in God's universe. Such understanding seems echoed in the declaration of Flannery O'Connor's perhaps most enigmatic character, the serial murderer of "A Good Man is Hard to Find." Jesus thrown everything off balance. It was the same case with him as with me, except he hadn't committed any crime, and they could prove I had committed one because they had the papers on me. I call myself the misfit because I can't make what all I'd done wrong fit what I'd gone through in punishment. In this regard, the Mormon view that there must needs be opposition appears to have more in common with certain Kabbalistic notions as expounded in the Zohar about the divinely assigned role of darkness or evil than does more conventional Christian philosophy. As for our own religious discourse, whether the approved rhetoric of our incessant mutual instruction or our personal idiosyncratic formulations, our other voices, what is any of it besides so much head noise? Needful, it would seem, but equally arbitrary, a welter of constructs whose significance may well lie far less in what is logically denoted than in the spirit that attends it, and which manifests itself more often than not between the lines. Regarding such constructs, we ought perhaps to recognize that part of caring enough about and believing a thing is to feel free to exercise one's own imagination to the point of making that construct one's own. Also, when any construct strikes as a sufficiently elegant and compelling, terms common, I believe, to the criteria mathematicians apply to an acceptable, if ultimately unprovable, hypothesis, we will more readily acknowledge, even accommodate it to our own belief system. Derrida's expression, "play," also seems to fit here. And surely it is only a matter of courtesy that whatever strikes another as ontologically persuasive, we ought to respect, along with the sacredness of that person's being, as the ritual or code of symbols with which he or she personally and reverently identifies. Otherwise, as one commentator puts it, we are all specimens driven by forces of which we have muddled awareness and over which we have small control. Or, as the poet Browning put it in Bishop Blougram's apology, our interests on the dangerous edge of things, the honest thief, the tender murderer, the superstitious atheist. And what of personal relations and the roles we've been assigned in others' lives? What of the individual and her quest for self-fulfillment? What does life require of us, and how many there indeed are who have set out to change this rather hardy but fairly intractable planet, yet sooner or later must give up, their efforts generally unrealized and of no account, if only through physical decline and the superseding of others who will for a time try their hand in the world's vast shuffle? How many of us feel the compulsive necessity to make something of ourselves or make a difference in others' lives, to control, manipulate, reform, and always with the best of intentions? Yet how often such efforts only prove self-defeating, even counterproductive, an excess expenditure of energy and concentration when, like the current of a swift stream, life's broad sweep carries us, despite our wishing otherwise, where it will. This would appear to be the position of the Yale Kennedy toward, again, historical outcomes in the current bestseller, The Rise and Fall of the Great Powers. Citing Machiavelli, the sociologist Daniel Bell in turn forcefully argues that men commit the error of not knowing when to limit their hopes. Radical change may well be to accept and wholly delight in who we are, in doing so, surely we manifest acknowledgement of and appreciation for, as well as affinity with, creation and its creator in a way we seldom do with any amount of anxiety-filled, duty-obsessed, sometimes all too wheedling and whining formal petitions. Indeed, there is an aspect of Judeo-Christianity which emphasizes stoic acceptance and contentment with whatever is given. We sense such soulful resignation in the Old Testament Psalms, and even in lyrics like those from Lauren Wheelwright's, "Lord, may my soul commune with thee. From worldly care, from pain of fear, oh, bring me sweet release." What then are some possible implications for an LDS believer? It seems to me that the restored gospel's striking emphasis on both free agency and eternal progression is remarkably consistent with the general worldview, which has here been so extensively mentioned. That many of the concepts bequeathed to us through Joseph Smith, the metaphysical and epistemological vision with which the Doctrine and Covenants and the prophet's sermons are replete, in many respects reflect this same openness and sophistication. The restored gospel's very here and now earth and human centeredness responds very well to Sheehan's insistence that the message of the kingdom of God is about Jesus of Nazareth, but only insofar as it is about every man and woman. As to his final allusion to the kingdom's Protestant moment of calling faith back to its origins and his admonition that the task is to make it so. Beyond this, Mormonism's cosmic definition of deity, not unlike the theophany in the Bhagavad Gita, God's literal identification as a supreme intelligence with light, the power of creation, the life force, and the corollary definition of human beings as co-equal intelligences and heirs, does much to affirm the ultimate purposefulness and rightness of whatever necessity, in Simone Weil's sense, we may be forced to endure. The straightforward consolation for and reconciliation with suffering, which Joseph Smith received at Liberty Jail, further affirms the potentially fortuitous role of tragic experience. And notice the contingent wording, if thou art accused, and if thou shouldst be cast, if, all if. We are normally disinclined to think in contingent terms. We seek the assurance that obedience guarantees us immediate, tangible blessings. But when circumstances prove otherwise, we can and do resort to the again stoic reassurance which at times sustained Joseph Smith. At the funeral this spring of one of the church's saintliest and most humane teachers of religion in Provo, a man taken at a too early age with a tumor of the brain, though assured of recovery the week before by high priestly blessing. The survivors were then reminded of Habakkuk's declaration, "Although the fig tree shall not blossom, neither shall fruit be in the vines, the labor of the olive shall fail, and the fields shall yield no meat, the flock shall be cut off from the fold, and there shall be no herd in the stalls, yet I will rejoice in the Lord, I will joy in the God of my salvation." We often enough assert why, with his inviolate respect for agency, God maintains a needful ethical distance and avoids too much intervening with his justice in the here and now. It is on such baffling occasions as that of the funeral of Jim Christensen that the reality of divine restraint, or respect, if you will, for contingency, clearly impresses itself upon us. The identification of our own intelligence with God's, moreover, however presumptuous, even blasphemous this may strike others, further allows far more than any traditional Judeo-Christian theology for the possibility that the most viable of all realities lies within us. To quote Rorty's paraphrase of the philosopher of language Donald Davidson, whose position Rorty himself strongly endorses. In yet another respect, the restored gospel can be viewed as reflecting Rorty's sense that any given rhetoric involves a particular vocabulary which is in a sense contextually specific and must needs be superseded. Revelations, we are told, are given in the idiosyncratic speech of the individual recipient, in his weakness and after the manner of his language. God communes, we are told, with all nations of their own nation and tongue, the implications of which we too seldom allow for in other traditions. Finally, like few other religious traditions, Mormonism does permit the continuing revision of its vocabulary through the principle of ongoing revelation. In a certain sense, moreover, Mormonism is remarkably doctrine-free, or if you will, doctrine-poor. While it attests to the reality of certain events, Lehi had a dream and traveled to the Americas, Joseph Smith saw the Father and the Son, the implications are left for each of us individually to interpret and recognize through personal revelation. The all-important role of the individual, of the working out of one's own salvation, as we say, is thus a fundamental tenet of Mormonism, correctly understood. One might even go so far as with Rorty again to recognize that, quote, the social process of literalizing a metaphor is duplicated in the fantasy life of an individual. We call something fantasy rather than poetry or philosophy when it revolves around metaphors which do not catch on with other people. Conversely, when some private obsession produces a metaphor which we can find a use for, we speak of genius rather than of eccentricity or perversity. This does not preclude the possibility that inspiration of a universal order underlies such fantasy or obsession. In addressing graduates of the University of Chicago, Wayne Booth has made a useful distinction. Quote, if we define truth not as man's formulations of reality, but as the basic principles of reality itself, the fundamental laws which make the world what it is and man what he is, whether discovered by man or not, then clearly truth is universal and absolute in the sense that it depends on neither times nor circumstances nor man's formulations for its existence as truth. Though truth in this sense, which has sometimes been considered an aspect of God's nature, presents itself to us in an unlimited number of perspectives, to say this is far from saying that truth is relative to our own private subjective preferences. It is relative only to the world of discourse we have chosen to operate in. End of quote. Nor does any of this suggest that we are not in need of each other or of supernatural assistance in realizing our utmost potential, or, as the scriptures put it, in sharing the divine fullness. But in all of this, surely individuality remains sacrosanct. The notion of a collective, a body politic, is itself, we should recall, a fiction. A concept in acting, called the idiosyncratic gesture, attempts to convey credibility through what is distinctive to a given character as reflected in the particular personality and mannerism of the actor portraying her. Paradoxically, without such a stamp or flavor of uniqueness, the sense of verisimilitude, hence of authenticity and ultimate human relevance, diminishes. The brilliant Polish theatrical innovator, Grotowski, has even gone so far as to insist that we must deride sacred norms in order to rediscover them. Perhaps this is because, as again Stephen Jay Gould contends, events and individuals, too, are unrepeatable. Hence, as Rorty puts it, echoing Forster's notion of bumping, the point of writing well is precisely to break the cusp of convention. Hence also his definition of freedom as the recognition of contingency. In the restored gospel, in the pristine concepts of Mormonism, there is room, I believe, for such an interpretation. In that same philosophy and worldview are further intimations which distinctly contrast with conventional Judeo-Christianity, even one might add with the received wisdom and common assumptions which many a Mormon rhetorically holds to. The Book of Mormon's definition of hell, for instance, emphasizes the sinner's state of mind rather than so much any specified locale or externally imposed punishment. This would seem to accord with the statement in the King James Version of John that the kingdom of God is within you. Again, a very psychological and person-specific phenomenon. Similarly, Mormonism's distinctive view of so-called original sin, essentially that there isn't any such thing, affords a far more expansive view of contingency regarding how we each come into this world than otherwise. In Mormon interpretation, prophecies are themselves seen as contingent, as statements of how under certain circumstances things might turn out, rather than as either strictly punitive or deterministic. Joseph Smith's very notion of an expanding gospel, and by implication universe, and his concept of eternal lives and of multiple deity to whose status and condition human beings have the impulse to aspire, in turn suggest a vision of dynamic, essentially illimitable, constantly metamorphosing human and spiritual potential. Indeed, the 13th Article of Faith and the Doctrine and Covenants' marvelously holistic definition of truth and prescribed curriculum for the school of the prophets not only invite, but also mandate an openness to all sources of truth, wherever we may find them, as well as a sense of the amorphous and incremental character of knowledge from which in our attempts in this century to codify truth and confine its philosophical pursuit, we have as a people radically and regrettably departed. From its outset, the restored gospel locked horns with much of the dogma which had so arbitrarily accrued and fossilized over nearly two millennia of Christian history. But like no other Christian movement, Mormonism opened its arms to the Judaic tradition which clearly preceded and underlay Christianity itself. In startling ways, moreover, particularly as the prophet Joseph made personal contact with them, the most esoteric sources relating to God's antediluvian and ancient order, especially pre-Columbian American, Egyptian, and Masonic, were readily assimilated into the restored church's writ and practice. Nor was contemporary scholarship, what many of us now classify as secular and view with such disdain, particularly feared or ignored. If anything, early Mormonism is a striking example of assimilation and synthesis, both intellectual and imaginative, as anything we know. It was heady and freewheeling, doing full justice when one thinks about it to what, in its most generic sense, many nowadays almost programmatically resist and default toward. That nevertheless off-sided maxim from the Restoration scriptural canon, the glory of God is intelligence. Indeed, if, as best we can rationally perceive them, both reality and predictable outcomes are so very elusive, the safest approach would seem to involve that distinction so rarely made between what tends to define us by internal as opposed to external criteria, and whose value perspective stresses persons and relationships over status and possessions, specific contexts over abstractions and theoretical absolutes. The fundamental concept, still so prominent in Mormon ideology, of personal revelation and of spiritual confirmation regarding beliefs, choices, and actions are, in fact, it seems to me, fully in accord with the view elsewhere that what we can collectively know or foresee and hence rely on is tenuous, uncertain, and largely incomprehensible. There was also the sense, declared to Joseph at Liberty Jail, that some of the most important understanding we can ever have is the consequence of experience. Not always pleasant or sought for, and very personal. How willing are we to entrust to one another the authority of personal experience in the ongoing process of growth and refined understanding? All of this might well lead us to conclude that to be too caught up in contention between those two external forces, authoritarian tradition and anti-authoritarian protest, is also to depart from that same mitigating spirit so essential to the religious life, which both more subtly and powerfully and so much less prescriptively informs each of us or can. Doesn't faith, that first principle of all religion, itself presuppose that the uncertainty of much we cognitively presume and all too confidently assert regarding both transcendent and mundane matters? Indeed, one might say that, like religious mysticism, the contemporary scientific and philosophical view finds corroboration in Kant's essential premise that it is impossible to grasp the nature of God through the exercise of the intellect, a view which has long rendered Kant anathema to all logical positivists while raising the stock of Hegel. Lovejoy's The Great Chain of Being might in turn help us see this phenomenon as part of a much older cyclical process in the history of ideas involving the ebb and flow of Platonic notions and the inevitable reaction to them. It is this very circumstance which, in my observation, more fully links with postmodern tentativeness, the truly authentic religious life, the life of dynamic, profound faith, than the overconfident, mind-made-up position of those who so totally disparage the religious disposition. Admittedly, all too often besets the pious, choose to operate from broad underlying assumptions, their own special premises, which allow them to arrogate to themselves the unfounded right to think the worst of and condemn others, often blanketly and with the most indiscriminate labels. This raises the question, who is least malleable, the broad-minded liberal or the provincial he or she so disdains? Who is most dogmatic, most stunted and stratified, most intolerant, most disposed to taking adversarial cheap shots, least secure and, again, least open to learning what most needs to be learned, to growth, change, personal refinement, and ever those hallmarks of civility, forbearance, goodwill, and genuine mutual supportiveness rather than their primitive opposites? On the other hand, and contrary to the notion that religion is by definition oppressive, I see the truly religious more readily presupposing that if there are wrongs, injustices, misunderstandings, it is not so much for them to scapegoat and project blame as to look to themselves, change their own uncharitable viewpoint, and irrespective of who is most culpable, be still accepting and forgiving and non-judgmentally committed to resolving any differences. In this mode, The believer is, I submit, emotionally and yes, spiritually, far more flexible and open to change, to be worked upon and to work upon himself, as well as more amenable to future contingency. His very realistic premise about himself is that he is still raw and finished material, not so very superior or grandiose, and in need of further refinement. In 1975, in a remarkable presidential address before the American Psychological Association, Donald T. Campbell declared that, quote, sophisticated behavioral scientists relapse into an epistemic arrogance and literalism when dealing with religious claims for truth. They hold up for religious discourse the requirements for a direct realism, a literal veridicality, even though they may recognize that this is impossible for science itself. End of quote. In compensation, he urges upon his fellow scholars a thoroughgoing epistemic humility that would make them more sympathetic to social system truths when packaged in non-scientific or metaphorical language. As another who has also rethought his former position, the anthropologist Robin Horton writes that the tradition-bound thinker is more critical and reflective and less conservative than I make him, and the modern scientifically trained thinker is less critical and reflective and more conservative than I make him. No one, no matter how learned or clever, is immune from a terribly inhumane yet all too common reactionary tendency. The confidence and sense of superiority which stem from an impressive or acclaimed intellect is particularly vulnerable to such unjustified arrogance. Witness the recent pettiness and condescension of numerous renowned physical scientists toward those who, residing in the shallow backwaters of the Mountain West, would presume to scoop them with another earth-shaking discovery. Still, it is such persons, more than the person of simple faith, who are, at least in theory, most qualified to appreciate the worldview now current. Its application in the realm of religion can, in turn, bring all the more alive a compelling sense of mystery, open-endedness, excitement, and, yes, reverence for life in all its aspects. In the words of a specialist on the early Soviet literary critic Mikhail Bakhtin, whose very name is now a buzzword to all the semioticians and deconstructionists, the world can genuinely surprise us, and we can surprise the world. As for that ultimate and inevitable prospect, death, that perhaps greatest of life's mysteries, even the believer is sorely tested. But what, by extension, and like Ivan Ilyich, we each need is to be prepared for, particularly as a matter of faith, is that, like everything else, death too will, when it comes, somehow marvelously bump us. And what if we then discover what is somehow at sundry and often unexpected moments intimated in our thoughts or suggested by peculiar circumstances in which we then often as not readily dismiss and forget? Namely, that as the remarkable Russian Orthodox theologian Yilchanin had once put it, if one is truly religious, nothing is accidental. And that there really is a grand order, as some theorists now argue, in the perceived universal chaos. That, too, would surely bump a number of us. Or in the paradoxical words of that other inspired Russian, Boris Pasternak, from the novel Dr. Zhivago, freedom came from the feeling that all human lives were interrelated, a certainty that they flowed into each other, that all events took place not only on the earth, in which the dead are buried, but also in some other region which some called the kingdom of God, others history, and still others by some other name. Does Pasternak's definition of freedom thus complement or contradict Rorty's recognition of contingency? Both are two of our century's most thoughtful, most penetrating spirits. Meanwhile, as citing Abraham Lincoln, Arthur Schlesinger Jr. has recently argued, there is something more genuinely religious about recognizing that God's mind and ours are not the same, and in our not presuming to know his mind and will, where in fact they have not been given us. In Lincoln's words, men are not flattered by being shown that there has been a difference of purpose between the Almighty and them. To deny it, however, is to deny that there is a God governing the world.
I'm very glad to be here this afternoon. I enjoyed reading Tom's paper. He's updated it several times, and I even enjoyed it more this last time. There was some new material in it. And I'm glad they asked me to reply to his very thought-provoking article on bumping. The world really is a place of surprise and wonder. Just 18 hours ago, I was in Mexico, and only 8 hours ago, I left San Diego to come here. Until I read Tom's article, the definition I had for the word bumping was what happens to you when the airline gives your confirmed seat away to somebody else. And I'm very glad I wasn't bumped in that particular way today. I'm also glad that I've been asked to respond to this paper. There's much in it which, as a physical scientist, resonates with my own experiences and observation. Tom argues, and cites reflections of others, that surprise, unpredictability, and a host of companion words and phrases which travel under the umbrella of bumping are essentially a part of what makes great music great, successful literary character successful, and provides the shock when the sweet mystery of life is at last uncovered to each of us. And in his conclusion suggests that death, too, will, when it comes, somehow marvelously bump us. Can the image of bumping be extended to other disciplines? Beginning with ideas of surprise, when the progress in a theme, to some degree, defies our expectations, and because we cannot entirely figure it out, both intrigues us and strikes us as more lifelike, Dr. Rogers conducts us on an odyssey which leads us to the contingency of history. Yes, it could have been otherwise. To the philosophy of science, as quoted from Gould and Rorty, that is, unrepeatability. To literary criticism, the substitution of center for center. To theology and scriptural exegesis, Sheehan's maintaining the undecidability of what is human and what is divine. And to the conflation of sacred and profane, typified by Dante, Dostoevsky, and Tolstoy. Rogers states, all fall under the concept of a lack of cognitive certitude and closure. Well, this is an accurate phrase. It's awkward, and I'm very glad that he came up with the phrase bumping. It's far better. At this point, Rogers turns to the possibility of affecting change. The concepts brought forward here are very stimulating. Lastly, Dr. Rogers turned to the implications for an LDS believer. These are many, and Tom presented some very stimulating thoughts, but a response is not a summary. And since I won't comment on all these ideas, neither should I summarize them now. I would like to discuss whether the ideas make sense from the point of view of the physical sciences. As I read bumping, an image came to my mind. I see at a table a man writing, and in effect, paraphrase, these are the words he wrote. Give me the starting positions and momenta of all the particles in the universe, and I will calculate the future. Outside, there's a flag snapping in the breeze. Clouds metamorphize as they pass. A brook gurgles, casting the leaves which fall, first in one bank and then another bank, in an apparently random fashion. Well, not only does the mathematician have no idea what's happening outside his room, but he doesn't even have any idea what he's going to have for lunch in 2 days. What do Laplace's words have to do with bumping? The dream of science has been to find a few simple laws which will allow us to predict an almost infinite variety of events. Laplace was, in fact, stating that vision more clearly than anyone had before. He had made many of the mathematical innovations which made predictions more accurate and calculations much more tractable than ever before. In the centuries which have passed, those mathematical formulations have been expanded, and with the advent of high-speed electronic computation have reached accuracy and power undreamed of by Laplace's generation. In fact, today on the airplane, I saw a New York Times headline stating, "Uncanny precision, Voyager bears down upon Neptune. Space probes have been launched and their paths have been computed in advance with unearthly accuracy years in advance." So are uncertainty, contingency, and an illusion? Does bumping fade away upon close examination? Laplace's statement was probably meant as an advertisement for his own accomplishments, like Archimedes, "If you give me a place to stand and a lever long enough, I shall move the earth." Archimedes' dream cannot be realized, but is Laplace's on the verge of coming true? There have been several developments in the last 100 years that bear on the question. The first two fall into the category of nature's limitations on what we want to do. Both of them come from the study of light and its relationship to matter. And people tend to be more acquainted with the first two, relativity and quantum mechanics, than the third, chaos, which I shall mention later. Relativity is nature's way of tying space and time together, while quantum mechanics deals with how very small objects exist in space-time. Besides lending its name to, and usually inappropriately, to a variety of phrases, relativity has very little to do with, very little effect on Laplace's dream of computing the future in principle based on the present. The limitation of quantum mechanics are far more serious. They state you cannot know both the position and momentum of a particle precisely. The theoretical limit, however, is such that this effect is only noticeable for the very smallest particles like electrons. Uncertainty for electrons is not quite the same as free will for human beings, but it's a start. Such developments have led to a philosophical retreat from the extreme reductionism of Laplace. Don't make statements about things you can't measure, was the advice that one early investigator of the new quantum theory gave to his colleagues. Here, the word can't implies that there is a fundamental limit set by quantum mechanics, set by nature, not by our equipment, on what can be known. In a reply to an essay on surprise, quantum theory and relativity merit comment another way. The word revolution often accompanies these accomplishments of modern physics. Relativity and quantum mechanics bumped our conventional classical view of how the world works and continue to offend the sensibilities of every student who comes in contact with them because they seem to defy our common sense understanding of how the world works. More important than quantum mechanics or relativity, though, in limiting Laplace's dream of determinism, is chaos or deterministic non-periodicity. Listen. Prediction in Laplace's sense involves quantitatively evolving the present positions and momenta of matter into the future. This union of space, time, and matter is done through equations. And now everybody's getting a little sick. Usually differential and integral equations. Laplace and other investigators dealt with a special class of equations which can be solved by algebra. Most of these are called linear equations. This involves simplifying the real equations and only, in fact, allowed a small number of real situations to be calculated. But it was easy to forget about that, and the assumption was that the behavior of the soluble equations set the limits and the behavior of what would be observed with the intractable ones. Surprise. This has proven to be entirely wrong. Some of the simplest nonlinear equations reveal complexity unimagined and should anchor the idea of unpredictability firmly into modern thought. Ironically, the tool which has revealed this is the same which made possible the realization of Laplace's dream for spacecraft. That is the advent of the modern high-speed electronic computer. This allowed the investigation of previously intractable problems, particularly the nonlinear equations of fluid flow. Water and wind are the prime examples. Jesus, in describing the Spirit to Nicodemus, said, "The wind bloweth where it listeth, and thou hearest the sound thereof, but canst not tell whence it cometh or whither it goeth. So it is with everyone that is born of the Spirit." Can we tell where the wind bloweth? Laplace and many early computational meteorologists would have said, yes, in principle, that's possible. Lorentz found out otherwise. His simplified models of worldwide weather about 30 years ago involved a mere dozen or so equations, but revealed many interesting patterns reminiscent of actual weather. Was prediction and control near? Restarting a calculation once, in the middle of the calculation, to look at an interesting pattern in more detail, he found to his surprise that while the wind and temperature pattern started out the same as in the previous calculation, in a short time, the two diverged until they were completely different. The problem was the numbers he had entered back in the second time were not exactly those the computers had in its internal memory. The small differences, one part in 100,000, had magnified until the similarity was gone and the difference was everything. This kind of thing is known as numerical instability and was known to be a part of nonlinear equations, but no one expected it to be so pervasive. The mathematician von Neumann and others had argued that there would be unstable points, and in fact, maybe by pushing appropriately at these points, we could change the patterns. Control of the weather is possible, some argued. Lorentz found out, however, that there's potentially an infinite number of unstable points. You can change the weather, yes, we change it all the time. Control the weather, no. A butterfly flapping its wings in Siberia can cause tornadoes in Texas. Or like phrase is the image which is often cited to invoke in our minds a model of patterns so unstable at all points. If you set out to control the weather, you will change it. But you won't get what you want. The formula for getting a royal flush is not to reshuffle an already well-shuffled deck of cards. But what does this have to do with Tom's essay on bumping? In the first place, Laplace's vision of calculating the future does not reflect reality. This is not because we can't do the calculations. Of course we can't. But because no matter how many measurements we make, no matter how accurate they are, there are cases where the divergences, tiny errors in our measurements, will take over. Hard determinism is dead, and radical reductionism is rendered not useful without reasonable roots, though I expect it will take a long time for everybody to notice. At this point, it's tempted to pick out, our favorite group for the honor of being the last to notice, but I will forbear, sobered by Brother Roger's admonition against taking cheap shots. The second correspondence with bumping is that chaos itself is a rather unexpected result. I was bumped upon learning the basics of chaos theory, as it is called, and filled with excitement that here is a paradigm to unite disparate disciplines. In fact, BYU physicist Neil Razvan argues that chaos theory may be the most important intellectual accomplishment of the 20th century, ahead of relativity and quantum mechanics. Might upset people interested in home teaching statistics, though. However, there's a more subtle way in which a discussion of deterministic non-periodicity is appropriate for a reply to bumping. Some of the concepts elaborated by chaos resonate with those Tom presented in bumping. Let me quote from page 1. Like the tantalizing progress of theme and variation in great music, they to some degree defy our expectation, and because we cannot entirely figure them out, both intrigue us and strike us as somehow more, all the more lifelike. This could as well be a description or definition of the complexity which arises from the simplest system to exhibit chaos. The logistic map consists of two simple equations. You can do it on a hand calculator. I did it in Mexico. The logistic map encompasses both boring periodic systems and apparently random chaos. Even systems which allow chaos, there are regions which are strictly periodic and predictable. In the chaotic regions, the Lorentz map, however, captures the theme of patterns that cannot quite be figured out. There is a repetition of any theme that you care over a short period, but always the pattern diverges. We are left with the feeling that there is a pattern, but we can't entirely figure it out. Lifelike models of trees and clouds and the jagged topography of mountains, both the turbulent flow of streams and the snake-like course of rivers emerge from chaos theory. What is the relationship between bumping and chaos? Well, I don't know. Chaos may be the mathematical language of bumping, or it may just be that these are sister concepts, here similar and other places different. It is interesting, however, that the disciplines where unexpectedness, unrepeatability, contingency, and undecidability emerge are the same ones where the logistics map is used. Developmental and population biology, ecology, medicine, economics, business, and information theory. Historians may be paying attention to chaos theory. They certainly ought to. Linguistics and criticism might find application of chaos theory, though to me it's less obvious how. Tom's essay is subtitled On Reconciling Contemporary Views of Knowledge and Causality with the Restored Gospel, and for half of its length, concerns how uncertainty, undecidability, tentativeness, and contingency can resonate with the experience of believing LDS. As a LDS believer, I find resonances of chaos as bumping with my experiences. Some are similar to those of Brother Rogers. In chaotic regions, We have control over our immediate environment. If a system is chaotic, the only thing that we are likely to change with any reasonable confidence of success are those things which we directly touch. What we can control over the long term is likely to be only our own internal state, our individual selves. Externally, life's broad sweep carries us, despite our wishing otherwise, where it will. Nevertheless, in the short term, we have control. And when we near a shore or a state we wish to be in, we can reach out and grasp what we will. What is agency? What of agency, rather? The wind is free. What about you and me? And if we are free, what is our freedom? Are we free like a reed which is tossed to and fro and carried with every wind of doctrine? Waving like a wave of the sea, or wavering like a wave of the sea which is driven with the wind and tossed? Or are we free to choose life and liberty according to the mediation of Christ, or captivity and death according to the captivity of the devil? Put another way, who wants to be bound over from Laplacian determinism to the playful grasp of chaos? Who wants to be described by an equation, even if it doesn't repeat? The questions are linked to another, since our freedom is in God. And what of God's knowledge and power? Is there room for God to act? What of God's foreknowledge? Does God know whence the wind bloweth and whither it goeth? Does the wind obey God's will, or is he like us, blind and impotent to the long-term patterns? Well, there isn't time, and this isn't the forum to address these questions, but I believe the Spirit of God is in the wind, and by subtle changes in earth, air, and water, compatible with chaos, and inevitably undetectable by my non-believing friends, conforms to his will, and in short order can bring, where he wills, drought or rain. These are some of my reflections to begin perhaps general questioning on Tom's very excellent essay, which I recommend to you.
It looks like we do have a very few minutes for questions. If you'd like to raise your hands and then direct your question to me. Yes.
I have a sort of a comment, but something different. I was being told how neat it was, the unpredictability here, but we've lost almost totally other than...
I did make the very same distinction a couple of times. I didn't dwell on it. Yeah. And I talked about the codification in this century, the prescriptiveness, which I think runs counter to this other view. And, you know, this may just reflect one's ultimate temperament to some degree. There are those who are much more content with certainty or with the illusion of certainty and wouldn't have that any of... They're not here today. And they include a lot of my kids. As a matter of fact, whom I love dearly, and I feel gratified that, you know, they're not wrestling at this point in their lives with some of these... contingencies the way I have, but I submitted a quote story to the recent Sunstone contest and wasn't too bumped when it didn't get the award, but as I showed it to Tim Slover, he commented, which was insightful for me, he said, "You're always this way in your thinking." He didn't use the expression bumming, but he said, "You state a case and then you say, yes but, you know, and then you might even go as far as a yes but your yes but, and it's, for me, that keeps us in balance somehow. And I don't know why I should say this here, if it fits or not, but one of the most inspired gentlemen I have listened to in ages came to BYU about 3 years ago now, the former Jordanian ambassador, a Muslim, and representing his king's position of moderation, one of the few groups who do in the Middle East. And he said, there are two things that we need in this world more than anything else, so badly, and with specific reference, immediate reference to the Middle Eastern situation. He said, we need sanity and we need moderation. And I thought how true and how profound that is. Somebody later said, well, how about compassion and forgiveness, all those Christian ethics? And of course, they fit there too. Somehow they should go with it. But you see, it seems to me that this bumping can, in our thinking, is putting us off base just a little bit, a little less sure of ourselves, can help with that, maybe that moderation, if not with the sanity.
Okay, so that our concept of chaos has changed.
Oh, yes, chaos is a well-studied
area. It's now something that can be defined.
Right.
And then
think of that and go home and show your wife, I'm studying chaos. And she says, well, I have it all around me.
And then my other question is, in the behavioral sciences, where we're trying to maybe
David, I'm aware of some books for the layman that have come out more recently that suggest there is order in chaos. And
there is some kind of order.
Yeah,
Like I said, there are patterns that continue, and then they fall away.